This podcast is brought to you by the new FXPhD Resolve 2012 Fast Forward course. Download 10 classes instantly covering DaVinci Resolve 9 and take your color grading skills to the next level. Visit fxphd.com.
Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show, where we're going retro. We're actually not going as retro as I guess we could. The film is King Kong. We're going to go retro to 2005. We're not going to go retro right back to the original Kong. Some of you had written in suggesting that we do that, though I think the historical accuracy at which I could talk about a film that far ago, we're better served by referring to other more authoritative tomes. But in the case of the 2005 version, I'm very keen to talk about it. And I'm keen to talk about it with my good friend Matt Wallen. Matt, how are you?
I'm great. Happy to be here to talk about this film. And I'm sure we will wind up having some parallel discussions with flipping back to the original King Kong, because I think there's definitely some obvious reasons to do so. So
true. So, yeah. Though people had suggested we do an entire show just on that film, not touching on this one. Mm. I just wanted to flag we're not doing that, because as great as that film was, certainly it's really a different problem altogether. And Ty Rubin, how are you, sir?
I'm doing very well. Thank you. Glad to be here.
So let's start as we do by a review of the show. Then we'll get into the visual effects. Obviously, this film, 2005, came out at a time not so long ago, but there have been significant advances in visual effects between now and then, so we do have to keep an eye on the film from a point of view of the technology that was available at the time and the incident that was done. But it was certainly a landmark film and went very well at the Oscars. So let's start with you, Matt. Did you like this film when it came out? By the way, spoilers, the ape dies.
Yeah, well, I had the fortune of working on this project in New Zealand. I was a compositor at Weta on the tail end of the show, probably for the last about 4 months of the project until it was completed. So I have a pretty intimate knowledge of this project from the effects point of view. And I was excited to work on the project. I was excited that it was being made. It seems like, you know, such a great idea to go back and remake really a seminal American film and a seminal film that has – oh, I was told I say seminal too much. I'm saying it again, but forgive me. But it really is one of those movies that the original King Kong that, you know, film theory classes, film history classes, you know, you always go back and watch that. And it's such a classic in terms of its visual effects and the animation of the original ape. And so to get a chance to work on, you know, kind of a modern computer generated remaking of it was really exciting. And I can talk some about that at more length as we get into the show, but
you worked pretty hard on it, if I recall.
Oh yeah, really hard.
And we might touch on that as well. But just the film, yeah. Like,
I think the film itself is kind of a disaster. I actually don't think it's a very good movie. I think there's many great visual effects in the film. There's also, I think, some really bad visual effects in the film. That I believe there's over 2,000 shots, visual effect shots in the finished movie. But I think it clocks in the theatrical release at, I believe, over 3 hours, right?
And 7 minutes. 3 hours and
yeah,
7 minutes.
And then there's even an extended edition, yep, of the movie that came out sometime later, whose running time is, I don't even know how much longer, another 20 minutes or something like that. And, the original King Kong, the 1930s version, I believe is, right around like 70 some odd minutes. It's much, much shorter and is a very taut and digestible narrative, and tells the story, I think, better than the remake, the Peter Jackson version. I think the Peter Jackson version is just, it's gratuitously long at times almost just unwatchable. I went back to rewatch it again in preparation for the show, and I couldn't get through it. I couldn't get through the whole movie. I just was like, oh, you know, I got so many other things I got to do. I can't sit here and watch this film. And I, you know, I skimmed through some of the sequences that I really wanted to check out in terms of their effects. But yeah, I actually don't think it's a very successful movie from my point of view.
Ty?
Well, you know, it's an interesting film for me in that I think it's for my brain, however my brain is set up, it's like two films. There's one film which is everything that doesn't relate specifically to Kong and his relationship with you know, the young woman. I mean, it's basically everything that doesn't have to do with those encounters and the Kong action in the picture is sort of how I split it out, because I actually really love the portrayal of Kong and the way that Jackson built up the relationship, you know, between a young girl and this, you know, kind of aged monster who over the course of the film you see a lot of humanity and emotion in, you know, a lot of those kind of endearing elements. But the larger picture that the traveling, you know, the setup for the story, the traveling in the boat, you know, the shenanigans, I would say, of the sailors and the film director, it kind of leaves me flat. You know, I can respect very much the work and the effort and the technological advances and just the quality of the work. But it has a certain kind of, I guess, shenanigan is the word I use, where there's a lot of kind of overcomplication of stuff that doesn't ring very true, you know, which is kind of one movie, almost like the Three Stooges kind of approach to storytelling, where calamity is afoot all the time and these wacky sort of things happen, like the T-Rex is hanging from, you know, vines and stuff. And then there's the other story, which I think is the emotionally charged story, which, you know, I actually say because of my own personality, and I'd be curious about your view on this, Mike, because of things we've talked about in the past, but there's a sense of great sadness that I get from the story of King Kong himself. And it really is difficult for me to watch the King Kong story. It when I saw it the first time, I was in tears at the end of the film, and I left in this kind of agitated state, and I never returned to it. And then when I saw it recently, I was surprised that it felt the same way. It's a train wreck emotionally for me. But the larger movie is, it's sort of not really part of those emotional hits, as it were.
I think that the filmmakers, Peter Jackson, obviously a very accomplished filmmaker, I think he's a bit of a prisoner to his respect for the original material, in that he so wanted to do things. Like, I believe there was a T-Rex fight in the original Kong that got cut for time. And he was so determined to come back and sort of put that back in because it never got in the original. And after I saw it, I was very much of the case of, well, I think it was cut for a reason. And this is the problem I think that we have as a modern film audience, and even especially as modern filmmakers, is that just because you can doesn't mean you should. And longer isn't better than shorter. And I'm reminded of that great quote. Was it from Bernard Shaw or somebody who said, I'm writing you a long letter because I don't have time to write you a short one. And I feel that that's what we've got here, because I couldn't agree with you more. You should take this film and just hack it at the script level to remove all references to T-Rexes and all references, well, not all references, but a significant amount of behind-the-scenes stuff, and just tighten the whole thing up. Because I did exactly what you guys talked about. I've watched this film between when it was theatrically out and when I watched it this weekend. And this weekend, I watched it in two sessions. I actually had to like have an intermission of a day because I couldn't do 3.5 hours straight. But I, you know, remember watching when it first came out on video, and I just fast-forwarded from when they got to Skull Island in bits and drabs until she was up on the rock looking at the sunset, and then I, you know, did a bit more fast-forwarding and got me to New York, because that stuff with Kong, when he is watching her dance, followed by Up on the Rock at the Sunset, followed by the performance both in the theatre and on top of the Empire State Building, is spectacular. I mean,
the ice rink. The ice rink scene.
Magical.
Yeah.
And this is, and I say the words performance, I'm not talking now about the visual effects. So obviously, they were the visual effects that delivered that performance. But I'm just talking about performance now. If that was an actor just giving a performance, it's a spectacular performance because you've gone from hating the guy and fearing them to loving them to fearing them to, and it's a complex relationship. It's not a simple, you know, there's almost overtones of a dare I say, romantic or even quasi-sexual kind of attraction that seems really weird and out of place to even say it out loud. But then there's adoration, there's sadness, there's pathos, there's just a ton of stuff going on there.
Well, a couple things that I think, you know, I want to go back to one thing you said earlier, and this might be just worthy of note. They shot over 2 million feet of film for this movie, which is roughly about 370 hours of footage, which is, you know, 123 times more than what you'd get in the final cut. And I do think, I could be wrong about this, but I do have I have a strong opinion about this, and I could cite several examples. I think we probably all could. I do think sometimes with very popular filmmakers who make films that audiences go to see again and again, and they become very successful. I do think there is a tendency that can happen with some of these people where they will go and they will have a very difficult time editing themselves, and they surround themselves with people who only say yes rather than people who maybe take a more critical eye, and sometimes they're willing to say, well, you know, you don't really need that, and challenge them and ask them to maybe, you know, make a case for why you have to keep this in and you can't lose that. And I think, you know, it's sort of the something that I feel like I've seen happen both up close with people that I've worked with, not on this show, but I mean in other projects, as well as, you know, seen from afar. And I do think sometimes, you know, not being able to edit yourself or to have, you know, people around you who you trust who will challenge you, which you probably have more often earlier in your career if you haven't had as much success. I think there's an inherent danger in that in filmmaking, especially in this big tentpole type of filmmaking, where you could lose your audience. You know, you kind of get so lost in the material and so caught up in, as you said, kind of the original source material and really wanting to harken back to that. And I think that the film fails in total on a grander scale, maybe because of that and maybe some of those kinds of issues. I feel like I see that at play oftentimes with, you know, people who have a lot of success at a really young age.
I mean, I'm going to say that one of the really interesting experiences for me is watching a director talk about the making of on a DVD when they have the deleted scenes. And I've had this many times, and the expression, for those of you that don't know, in editing is killing your darlings. But I saw, the most recent example I can think of is Love Always. So nothing to do with King Kong. And this is Richard Curtis talking. And there's a scene in that film where there's a poster on the wall. And I don't know if you remember, this film is like a romantic comedy kind of thing. It was very kind of multi-leveled plot going on. There's a poster on the wall of an African village, and the place they're working at is a charity. And this poster kind of features a little prominently, but not that much. And in the making of section, there's a whole scene where this poster suddenly comes to life, and you go into that scene and you see this African couple that are on this poster in the sort of, you know, send aid to Africa poster, having a discussion about marital problems. And the whole point of this was that culturally, in places you would never think of, like the savannah, they're going to have problems of my husband's not very good, but oh gosh, I love him anyway. All the same discussions that you would have in our world are not exclusive to our world. They happen in every human context. And so he amplified that by having a very classic kind of almost New York-y, London-y kind of dialogue sequence happening in, I presume, like Swahili or whatever it is, in Africa between these people on the savannah talking about their husband. And it was one of the scenes that he really wanted to do to make the film. And it's spectacular. And he says, yeah, I just had to cut the whole thing because we just wanted to get on with seeing what she did with the guy in the office. And this was just didn't further the story, so I had to cut it. And you can feel his pain because, well, he made exactly the right decision. This is incredibly funny, insightful. It underlines the point of the film. It just didn't work because it made the film too long and just moved us away from caring about these main other characters. And whenever you get a director doing that, I just like respect them so much. And I could have seen a DVD of King Kong where they showed an amazing amount of sort of animatics of T-Rexes and had PJ say, you know what, I just wanted to redo the whole scene of the T-Rex fight and I thought we could do a really, really good job. But, you know, once we're on the island, we just needed to keep it moving. And it just was like, I would have loved to have done this, but just couldn't do it kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But for whatever reason, he didn't do that. And you don't get that. And yeah, okay, I'm sure there are a million other bits in the making of DVD deleted scenes for King Kong. Obviously, it sounds like from what you're saying, but it didn't feel in the cinema like we'd had a really story-driven edit. There was just, like, there were darlings in there that I really honestly thought, okay, this director so wanted to see a fight between Kong and T-Rexes, and not just one, but three, and a beautiful choreographed, amazingly done visual effects sequence that just didn't need to be there.
Yeah, well, it's set piece after set piece after set piece in the structure of the film that doesn't necessarily move the narrative forward. Yeah, and I think, you know, when it feels like it's just a set piece for set piece's sake, you know, big action sequence, sometimes it just sort of feels hollow. And if you do it too many times, especially, then I think it really starts to fall flat. Now, the other thing, when you guys are talking about the emotional quality of Kong, I feel like, and that, you know, it's like Ty, you were saying it's a film that, you know, really affected you emotionally and the sort of story, there's kind of this, you know, real tragic kind of almost love story. And you even alluded to it, Mike, you know, the sort of awkwardness of even kind of this sort of sexual relationship. I feel like, you know, we would be remiss if we didn't mention, I'm sure you guys have seen Inglourious Basterds, the Tarantino film, right? And there's the scene in the movie where the soldiers are sitting around some, you know, bar in a moment of rest, and they're playing a card game where they're like a party game with cards where they're putting cards on their foreheads, and one of the characters has King Kong written on his forehead. And so you're asking the other guy questions and trying to figure out, like, well, who is it? You know, and they say, well, you know, you were brought to the United States in chains, but you grew up, you know, in the, you know, tropical environment. And they have this whole conversation that's really interesting where they talk about whether or not Kong is a metaphor for the American slave trade, and that the love story is this sort of, you know, America's fear of interracial relationships. And I think, you know, it's hard not to look at the original King Kong or look at that after you hear that story and not see that that reading certainly has some merit. And, you know, there was a great interview I heard with Quentin Tarantino on, I think it was on Fresh Air with Terry Gross, and I think shortly after Inglourious Basterds came out, and he was talking about that scene. And he said, you know, the problem he had with Peter Jackson's King Kong is it felt like there was really almost no interpretation of that, you know, subtext, which, you know, Tarantino, at least in his mind, felt was 100%, you know, just totally blatantly obvious. Like, you couldn't watch the film and not see it or read it in that way to some degree. And that, you know, if you remove that component from the story, then it's so ridiculous. Like, it's literally a story about a giant gorilla who falls in love with a woman. Right. And it was sort of an interesting commentary. So I feel like, you know, it's something worth bringing up, whether or not I think whether or not there is this other kind of underlying subtext. And if it's important to, you know, deal with issues like that and to address those kind of things that would come up in a film, or is it really just, and was it always a straight up a monster movie with zero social commentary intended?
Ty, I don't know what you think about that, but I would say I certainly would not see that as the only issue. There was another layer of stuff to do with not appreciating, you know, beauty and nature. And I had like a whole sort of conservation line over the top of it that was not as deep as the slave trade one. What did you think?
Well, you know, I listen to that, and that is a very interesting assessment. I mean, you know, I think that there is something about basically snatching something from where it belongs in the context of the time frame, and then kind of using it for folly or entertainment or labor or whatever. I mean, that's pretty. That's a pretty interesting way to start a dialogue or to look at the material and talk about it. I think what I was referring to, though, and maybe this plays right back into the visual effects part of it to a degree, is so many of the characters, in my opinion, and I would say like even the T-Rex or the stampeding dinosaurs, everything's on point. There's nothing mysterious about the motivations. The Jack Black character is greedy, or he's greedy in a way about prestige, or he wants to promote his vision of himself. He's driven by very simple, identifiable emotional needs. He's not a complex character. The Brody character, although he's presented as a moody kind of thoughtful poet, he in the movie he's just a love interest. He just kind of is stolen away and so forth. But when it comes to to follow up with my own example, the T-Rexes just want to eat everything. The bugs just want to, be bugs and jump on everybody. The sailors just kind of, even though one of them reads, Hearts of Darkness, they just kind of are the Keystone Cops of the film. But when it comes to the Kong character, he's played in a very multidimensional way because it's done like mime, just pure mime.
Mm.
There's a sense that he is losing his authority of the jungle. He is the failing king. He's clearly older. He's scarred. He presents himself as the big bully, but yet when he's tired, he gets up to the top of that mountain, and he's exhausted, or at least emotionally, if not physically. You see the skulls of his ancestors or his wives or his friends or whatever, and you're given a sense that he's the last of his kind. He's like the last king from the Dark Continent that really, had once been kind of noble. Had maybe once been the rightful king of this place. But now he's just kind of waiting to be the last of his kind, Then when he is brought eventually, and, of course I could go on and on. I mean, I think the way that the relationship between the and Darrow character and him build up is sort of interesting, although in my mind she is more a victim of the story than the Kong character is. I mean, she kind of has to play the certain beats, and you're a vaudevillian actress, and now she's going to do a dance and entertain Kong. But Kong continues to be kind of a surprising mime character. Until when he gets to, the city, the performance of him growing aggravated and being disappointed with the girl not being the right one and losing his temper and then getting up onto the audience and then being fixated on, it's very rich in its complexity. And I think it overshadows the entire rest of the film. Even to the very ending where he kind of sloughs off the roof of that building, there's a sense of, like, sorrow and weird, subcontext. It's not on point at all. And I think that's where the actual genius of the film lies, in getting that fidelity of character out of scale with humans, with a different anatomy. Of course, the eyes were played very real. But I really was affected, and I think I was affected not just because of the things I'm proposing with his movement and his postures, but there was also this animalistic side that speaks to me of my favorite pet dog, or the scared dog down the block, or the mean dog that chased me.
Yeah,
home.
It was not just that they anthropomorphized the ape to be, like in Rise of Return of the Legend of the Planet of the Apes, where Caesar, clearly becomes much more human, and I totally agree with you. I think that he had properties that, until you said, I hadn't articulated it, that I see in my dog. You're absolutely right. Or in an animal. And also a kind of curiosity come frustration of not quite understanding what's going on at times. That was just a very nuanced performance. But I think what you said there, if I could just paraphrase it, is actually more like the genius of the visual effects in this film, not the genius of the film per se, because that delivery of that performance is like the landmark part of this film. I mean, you can point to a whole lot of things in this film that were awesome, but that ability to convey that range of emotion on that character's face, that isn't just human, that is still got real animal. That is the genius that made it worthy of Oscar attention, I would say.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and the fact that you are able so much as an audience member, really more than any other character in the film, with Kong, you empathize with him, you know. You can sort of feel his pain, as it were. You know, you can kind of feel what he's going through, and you're made to identify with him much more so than any other character.
I mean, I had a motivational problem with the T-Rexes, because in my experience with wild animals, they tend to do what's in their best interest, and they rarely just vindictive or whatever. So if a T-Rex is thinking that it can get something to eat, it's going to get something to eat. If it can't get something to eat, it'll go get something to eat somewhere else. It seemed to me the motivation for these T-Rexes on their sort of quest to try and get Kong, or even to get her, she didn't seem to be that much of a mouthful that it'd be worth it. You know what I mean? Like, it just, I started to get to a point in that entire T-Rex sequence. It's like, why don't these T-Rexes just back off, you know? Yeah. Like a dog.
Well, you know, it's interesting because when we were working on Jurassic Park, and which was 10 years earlier, right? I think it was a little more than 10 years, 12 years earlier. Yeah. The notions that we were investigating, the themes and concepts that Dennis Mirren and the team with Phil Tippett and the team that was at ILM was going for the kind of thing you're suggesting. It was going for realism in terms of like a safari, like you actually are encountering these animals for real. That model did dissolve away quite a bit in the final third of the film, but when you look at those iconic moments on the rainy roadway with the T-Rex, the decisions were always made to make it kind of naturalistic in its behavior, and not try to superimpose on it a lot of cinematic necessity of action, as it were. Mm-hmm. And it's funny that in a way that plays to the realism of the dinosaur as a living, breathing, biological animal on Earth. Once you kind of direct it like a human or somebody in a costume, I think it automatically brings a certain falseness to it, which, if I'm hearing you correctly in your assessment, Mike, I think that it was also what starts to happen in that long dinosaur sequence, is it just starts to seem more like an amusement park on a ride, like things are alive and running, and there's a kind of calamity Keystone's Cop kind of a mentality. And it, I think it dampens the potential for your eyes and your brain to take it as real. It sort of becomes vaudevillian in a not vaudevillian the way that the movie suggests, but it becomes based, the calamity becomes about a comical unfolding almost without a lot of genuine, fear or a genuine sense of dread or calamity is going to turn bad. It's sort of almost more of a clever construction of events.
I mean, I would have loved to have seen the T-Rexes frightened when they went over into the vines, because any animal of that size, that's used to being sure-footed in an unstable environment, I imagine would be frightened. I don't imagine that gravity is, they're impervious to that. And so it would have been much more interesting to me that instead of it's trying to swing to bite her as if somehow biting her would solve all problems and that's its end goal, I would be it's trying to accidentally kill her because it's so scared of being caught in the vines and being suspended up, and that she's like an innocent kind of irrelevancy that's going to get trampled, and that's the threat on her. But when it's swinging in the vines and when it's doing a bunch of that stuff, it's like, really, you are either it's intellectualizing enough, I'm okay because I'm caught in these vines, at which case I'm giving it a level of intellect I don't think it deserves, or it's just stupid to the point of not that the animal's stupid, but the plot isn't, like, just doesn't give me the justification for that T-Rex acting that way. And of course, I don't care about the T-Rexes dying either, because they never engage with me.
Yeah, if I may, on that point, is something Matt said in the very opening of the show, which I think is an interesting observation as well, is that it's a series of set pieces. It's a series of set pieces that are not necessarily connected to one another by the narrative of the picture. It's not like the set pieces are part of the dramatic arch. It's more of segues, like, we're going to sidestep now to have this T-Rex piece, and then we're going to sidestep to have the boat crashing piece.
Yeah,
and
it's spectacle and then, for spectacle's sake.
Yeah, and I think it, and if it smacks of one thing, and your point, Mike, about the brain of the T-Rex, I would go one step further and say I've been in meetings where your storyline is kind of laid out, and you're sort of, you know, you have a moment with the writers or with the director and maybe a couple of key people in there. They're saying, wouldn't it be great if, you know, how could we up it? What if it went even further? Like, the T-Rexes don't just fight them on the ground, but what if they dove down from rocks? And they go, what if they got caught in vines, you know? And it's the amplification of the set piece that I think creates moments like that, as opposed to when you're really sitting around and saying, well, I've always envisioned this moment where the Rexes would get caught in vines. You know, no. It's probably with something like, how can we elevate this to the next level? And then, therefore, you start to – it manifests the action need without the narrative need, and then you get these kind
although – I agree, although I would say in the right picture, you know, those kind of moments can be the moments that, like, you know, make the audience kind of just like their jaw drops and they're like, oh, absolutely, man, you know, like, that's crazy. Like, it's just such a nutty moment. Like, you know, oh, it's just gone so far beyond. But in the sort of emotional gravitas that I think the story tries to create, that I think you're right. I think the set pieces, at least in the way that they're woven or really not woven into the narrative, detracts from, I think, the larger effort that the film is trying to make.
And yet I would say that the musculature and the muscle under the skin action, especially when the dinosaurs are doing that, Kong's gone over the lip and he's kind of pulling one down, and there's like rock that sort of falls to another rock and then way down into the vines, and there's a point where he's holding her, and there's a couple of dinosaurs, one sort of ends up with on his foot. And I was watching the way the muscles were working on the T-Rexes that were being pulled down from the top rock to the sort of camera right rock. And it was really good stuff in terms of, you know, if you were the guy responsible for doing the animation and the modeling and the Sims work on that. Mm-hmm. It's horrible that we're being this nasty about it, because the work looked so good. But I'm afraid that's just
I think there's a lot of great work in the project that we could talk about. I mean, you know, it's an interesting show just in terms of the time. I was on the compositing team, and what was most interesting, one of the most interesting things to me looking back is that this was really the last big Shake show that I ever worked on. And Shake was, you know, discontinued at this point, and the source code was being sold to facilities with, you know, X amount of licenses and whatnot. And it was basically being, you know, stripped like a, you know, like a Mercedes in a bad neighborhood or whatever, and was being parsed out to other, you know, elements of the Quartz engine or whatever in the Mac operating system, and into Motion and maybe some of the tools into Final Cut as well. But so it was really the last big Shake show that I worked on. And, you know, one of the things that was happening, though, while I was working in Shake, was there was one of the comp supervisors. I think he was a comp supervisor. He might have had a CG supervisor title. I can't recall. But it was Eric Winquist, who was there. And he was using Nuke, a really, you know, sort of an earlier version of Nuke at this point. But and really getting heavily involved with the 3D engine in Nuke, and was working really closely with Michael Pingrazio, the matte painter, and they were constructing a whole host of really complex and very rich virtual backgrounds. And I know they had done a little bit of this as well on, or maybe actually a pretty significant amount on the Lord of the Rings films, but this was really pushing it to a whole nother level. I think, you know, it's really a great starting point. And really, these guys were, I think, breaking some really cool new ground in terms of what they were able to put together. And you really see the payoff of a lot of that work in shows like Avatar, in terms of the virtual backgrounds that were generated for that show. And so I think, you know, there's certainly some really interesting things that were going on. Not to mention that, but there's also you know, Chris White, who's a CG soup, still, I think, at Weta, and he worked with his group, and they did the whole CityBot thing, where they constructed basically in, you know, a framework in Maya, a system by which they could generate very quickly. They did a, I think they presented a paper on this too in a video at SIGGRAPH in, I think, 2000.
To the procedural city stuff?
Maybe. Yep. So, yeah, all the procedural city stuff. Yeah, and I mean, that stuff is amazing, where they had a library where they were able to basically go in, I think just in MEL, in the My Environment language, and go in and, you know, kind of type up what type of building it was. And then there was like a library with some, I don't know, 90,000 or plus, maybe more than that, you know, parts. And this CityBot system was able to really just go in and kind of generate the types of buildings that they would want and create this cityscape for this kind of 1930s era New York, which, you know, didn't exist anymore. And the results, in my opinion, you know, the CityBot stuff and the virtual New York, I mean, I think that is some of the best work in the film and really just incredible, incredible stuff.
I have to say that you're right. I mean, there are technological sort of flags in the sand here that totally correctly identified this, the motion capture, the generation of the cities, just like the way that what was happening in this film facilitated a lot of stuff that's come after it and was without a doubt spectacular, both from a technical point of view and a creative point of view. And because I thought New York looked awesome. I mean, there was like obviously a set, there was a block built, but there was nowhere near what we saw in the film, and not even a sort of a sensible percentage of it. It was real, and I thought it was fabulous. It looked really, really good. I was watching the opening sequence, which I'd really pretty much forgotten about. You know, this whole thing where they were sort of setting up the times and the Depression, and it would cut really nicely between clearly live action pieces and what I must assume was digital pieces, and it set a great tone. I don't know I needed it in the film, but it, as an isolated sequence, it was just beautifully done. As, you know, remember the guys are climbing on the scaffolding and building the skyscrapers, and, you know, these are just really, really good shots. I did have a problem, changing subject again slightly, I did have a slight problem in this film. I remember when I saw it, that I was, every sunset's the most beautiful sunset I've ever seen. Every lighting is the most spectacular lighting I've ever seen. And I did feel a little bit that, the lighting in New York showed an overall luminance level, as did the park for that matter, that wasn't motivated by the available lighting. Now, I don't know whether that falls under the category of stylistic or erroneous. I don't know what you guys think. But did you get any of that?
Well, I mean, I think I think that there was often a kind of surrealist quality or a hyper reality quality to you know, the skies, for example, that was a kind of richness, a patina actually of sort of a kind of dreamy richness that I thought in my mind it played most often when it was Kong and you know, when it was Kong work, when Kong was there. Maybe that's just because the shots were set up against the sky a lot and I noticed it more. Or, you know, maybe it's because those were the moments where, you know, the environment played in a slightly different way. Maybe much to the other time it kind of just cruised by and I wasn't as aware of it. But, yeah, I would echo that. I think that there was a certain kind of artistic direction, if nothing else, to kind of bring in this romanticized 1930s, right? But I guess if I look at a place like, you know, the landing on Skull Island and, you know, the natives and those things, I don't recall it, of course, because most of the shots are looking down and more in the jungle, and so it wouldn't be as noticeable. I think New York or, you know, the city stuff all looked very hyper real, you know, excellent, especially in the last. In the beginning, it was a little grittier, kind of the documentary style that they used a little bit to establish the Depression and such. But at the end, I think once Kong arrives in the theater to the very end of the movie, it's on a kind of more pastel-y, rich, kind of romanticized level. Even the color of the car is really punchy, and the street lights and all the signage and stuff was all kind of you know, it's like one from the heart, right? It's a little bit of that kind of stylized city stuff.
There's
I was just gonna say tons of the cars and, you know, stuff in some of the larger shots of Times Square and whatnot were all done with using Massive. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of cool to go back and think about too. You know, the use of it to do something, you know, other than you know, giant fight scene with a bunch of, you know, warriors clashing or whatever. To use it as, you know, a an engine to drive, you know, tons of little vehicles and stuff around the cityscape, I think was really successful as well.
So interestingly, that did lead to Massive coming out with Lions, the traffic part of Massive.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And only recently they fixed the problem where if a truck or a vehicle got off the lane, the agent just didn't know where to go. And so they just drive through a building.
Careening off, yeah.
Whereas now they get off a road, they come back onto it again. But, yes.
Yeah, the other thing, you know, in terms of sort of, you know, really sort of groundbreaking, as you said, planting the flag in another territory, is how difficult it was to do a full, you know, 3D, full res render of Kong with all the fur and all the fur dynamics in place. And Dan Lemon was a CG soup on this show. And Dan, I know you've talked to him, Mike. He's just a great, really nice guy. And he was a visual effects supervisor, if I'm not mistaken, right on the rise of the Kong of the planet of the
legend of the orangutan
of the planet of the stuff. And you know, by the time I got there, the show had been underway for you know, probably a good year at least production. But to my understanding, by the time I got there, when they were only, I think, about 4 months left, they still hadn't done a full CG render of Kong with working fur. And so the team that headed up the creature group that was dealing specifically with all the fur and hair dynamics and stuff, I think, you know, they were just busting their brains and spending late nights and long hours doing everything they could to get this stuff to work, you know, under the supervision of Dan and I think Joe, certainly Joe Letteri as well, trying to get all that stuff to work. And I think in the end, you know, you look at the final results. Like I had a one sheet that I got at the show, and I have it hanging in my office at school. And I was looking at it today while I was sitting in, you know, office hours to see if any students came by. And I was checking out the poster and reading some of the material that Todd put together in the dossier for the show tonight. And I was just looking at that poster, and it's a full, you know, CG render of Kong's face close up, where you see all the scars and the details and the detail in the eye. And there's even like a little bit of like leafy sort of debris caught up in his beard, you know, from traversing through the jungle. And you look at that, and I was telling the woman that I work with, the administrative coordinator in her department, she came by for something, and I was talking about, I said, you know, that's a computer-generated image. That's not a photograph. And she's looking at it, and she's just like, what? No, that's like a costume. You know, that's like a makeup thing. That can't be a computer-generated image. And I think it's interesting that, you know, the average person looks at that and doesn't really see what's really there and doesn't see the work that goes into it, which is a great testament to its success. But I think, you know, this is really the first time that we had something, a character of that scale, of that scope, that was required to carry, like we've been saying, the emotional content of the film. And, you know, if that didn't work, you know, the whole film was a goner. And the fact that they pulled it off, and they pulled it off so amazingly well, and really set the stage for the work that they then, I think, continued really well later with the Planet of the Apes film, I think is, you know, something else really worthy of note in terms of really just amazingly well done effects.
Yes. I think there's one other bit that I wanted to flag that we haven't mentioned at all, but I remember at the time actually seeing some of the work that somebody did and was stunned. And I don't think it was in a King Kong production diary or something, but anyway, there was a thing about the Roto team. And I just think that we need to give them some points, because I totally agree with you that the fur and the scarring and the texturing on Kong was magnificent. But I'm also a sucker for anyone that can deal with the complexity of rotoscoping a woman running through a bunch of ferns and having stuff with motion blur and stuff flying around and needing to just roto that. And I'm pretty sure it was done like in Matador or something.
Or yeah, well, Matador, I think it was Silhouette. Or maybe Commotion, maybe.
But it was incredibly painstakingly done. And there were vast amounts of it as well.
Well, on the if I might, just on the comp crew, I mean, we worked really closely with rotoscopers, and I mean, they did the most hardcore, backbreaking, painstaking work. And there was a on the company intranet, there was a a link that you could click on that somebody had assembled, and it was all of all these plates that were so. Now, you know, in production, I mean, we all know this, right? We've all worked on effects films and stuff. And when they're when you're in production and you're shooting, you know, background plates with live action against a blue screen, I mean, you know, we all want to have that perfect blue screen where it's all evenly lit and stretched out, or green screen or whatever, where it's all, you know, perfectly lit and nice and even and stuff. And, you know, everybody knows that that's just – it's rare that that happens and that it works out that way. And Kong, I will say, of all the shows I've worked on – without question, had some of the worst plate photography I've ever seen. And I think that was not, you know, I wouldn't say that there was someone at fault for that. I would say that I think the case was largely that there was so much work and such a rapid-paced production schedule that there was oftentimes where, you know, they were just getting as much coverage as they could. The take that wound up working in the cut was the one where, you know, the other guy, what's his name, Adrian Brody and Naomi were swinging on a vine, and there's blue screen all around them, and the one place where they are, where their hair is on a gray concrete floor with cables and dolly tracks, you know, like, and it's just one of those things, like, there's nothing you can do. And they had put together a link of all these, you know, frame cycler clips of all these plates. And I remember sitting down one day, somebody showed it to me, one of the other compositors showed it to me and was like, dude, you got to check these out. And I, you know, I was taking a lunch break or whatever and was sitting there and watching these clips. And I was laughing so hard. I was almost crying, but I was laughing because it was clearly going to be so difficult, if not almost impossible.
It was just cruel, wasn't it? Yeah.
I mean, it was so, it was like gallows humor. You know, we're putting in these really long hours and looking at this stuff, and everybody knew it was just like, oh man, we are up against like a wall here. Like, this is some of the hardest stuff, both on Roto and Comp, that you're going to ever have to face. And, you know, I do think, and I could cite several examples if you want to go into it, but I do think there are certainly some really bad comps in this show. And this is coming from somebody who comped on the show, so comps too. But there's some really bad. And I think the reason why some of them are so bad, I think there's a host of reasons. And you know, some of them have to do with lighting, and some of them have to do with plate photography. But I have an image that I think, well, I don't want to say who put it together, but it was somebody that I worked with on the show, and they made a fake Cinefex cover. And it's a picture of the two actors swinging on a vine in front of like an entire blue screen stage. And the only place where they're being photographed from has them in front of just gray concrete. And it is so funny. It says Cinefex in the upper left-hand corner. And people just had such a sense of humor about it because, you know, there was nothing you could do. You kind of had to deal with it. But I do think that you look at the one that I think was notoriously a sequence that was notoriously leveled as having been one of the most difficult ones comp-wise, and that I think people even commented on at the time when it came out as thinking like, ooh, it was kind of tough, was the big brontosaurus chase. And the way in which the actors are comped into the sequence where all the, I think the brontosauri or whatever, brontosauruses, are running down the cliffside and down this sort of chasm. And the actors are running in front of them, and then they kind of are underneath the legs of the brontosauruses and stuff. And I think looking back at that sequence, I watched it again, actually just this afternoon, I went and looked at it again. And you know, I kind of feel like one of the things that makes it so difficult for that to really feel right is that I think the camera movement is a little bit kind of off in terms of the tracking of the 2D element with the 3D sort of replaced background, but also the lighting on the actors is very diffuse and doesn't have the hard light and hard shadows that is then created and lit in the CG. And so they do feel very much kind of, you know, it feels very A over B in some of those sequences. And I think they suffer maybe because of maybe some of the way the plates had been shot, but also I think they suffer too from, you know, just maybe some poor planning at some point where, you know, lighting wasn't set up to match and they were, you know, trying to tackle so many shots. I mean, we're talking about 2,000 shots and, like I said, you know, 2 million feet of film, right? You know, 370 hours worth of footage. So, you know, I think the scope and the scale of what was being shot maybe also played into that somewhat.
Hey, just before we get to those bad shots, Ty, can I ask you a question? Did you have the same roto problems on Jurassic? Or would you know if there were the same roto problems
on
Jurassic?
You know, I was going to say, it's so funny that should come up in a movie with, like, we were talking about dinosaurs and stuff, is that I was actually, as the effects art director, my primary desk and workplace was in the art department, and I would travel from the art department to different meetings, and because of the complexity of Jurassic and I think because of the way that Dennis Muren liked to set up his team, they moved me way across the campus, the ILM campus, into a desk that was kind of in with the CG guys. And you know, they were all, at the same time, there was, of course, the team was being added to, and cabling was being put in to, you know, get the workstations hooked up to the renderers and all the backup drives. And it was like a very chaotic evolving environment. But it just so happened to be put in a room with a woman by the name of Carolyn Rendu, who had been a rotoscoper with cells. She'd been working at ILM for several years doing rotoscoping on top of an animation stand with the footage, you know, being projected up underneath. And then she was using, they used a special blackout material to create physical holdout masks for use in.
Really hardcore. That's great.
Yeah, no, that's what she had been doing. And I remember when she got into this office and was sitting behind me, she was able to use a very early digital tool to create the mats and then, save them off save them off individually to be used in a digital compositing environment. But the thing that she told me that was the most awesome, because I was talking to her about the tools, and she said the thing that was most awesome was that the room had air conditioning. You know, that she was sitting, because all day long she used to have to sit with this projector beam up underneath the table, you know, blasting light at her all day long. And suddenly now she was, you know, sitting at a desk in an upright position, you know, without gloves, without, a brush in her hand and a little jar of spillable fluid, writing numbers down to make sure they're all in sync. Suddenly it was, you know, all connected, and I'm pretty sure that then they brought another person over from Roto who was doing the same work in that environment, and they were ecstatic, and that was what I remember thinking, that if you made a mistake and you could go back and fix it, whereas, you know, just the year before you'd have to go get all the cells, fix the one cell or two cells that were wrong, and then reshoot the whole sequence.
Yeah.
You know, so it, I remember that, and it is a kind of underappreciated art form at that time, for sure. With the non-digital tools, it's almost like magic. Then with the digital tools, that ability to to discern, like Matt's discussing, and make things work, and it's tedious in a way that it takes a certain focus that I guarantee I don't have. And so, yeah, it's pretty impressive stuff.
All right. Well, as much as I don't want to, we're on a bound to. So what shots do we think sucked from a technical point of view, not from a – and what do you think not worked? I mean, we've set it up, Matt. You're going to have to answer it.
I think, you know, the Brontosaurus chase is one of the most difficult ones for me to watch. And I do think, too – and I wish I didn't feel this way, but I do think one of the hardest parts is the sort of the big jungle chase when Anne is sort of first kidnapped and then she's taken in Kong's hand. And I think there's a lot of problems in that sequence. Anytime where we're looking at her in where she's a live action element and she's not a digital double, because I feel like, one, I mean, you like to talk a lot of times, Mike, I think, about sort of the physics of some of the stuff, right? And, you know, if she was really being thrown around in that fight scene, you know, from palm to palm with Kong, I mean, like her back would break and her head would fly off or whatever, right? Because just sheer physics just don't make any sense. But I think there's so many instances where, she's wearing, the actress, Naomi Watts, in the piece, she's wearing this kind of, you know, this really yellowish kind of peroxide-y looking wig throughout the film. And that hair and her sort of general complexion, she's very pale actress. And I think, when you see her complexion and her hair in a lot of those sequences, she just doesn't sit well in there. And she was a really, I mean, speaking from personal experience, there were so many elements where she was just real tough to comp into the scene and to get her to really look like she was there and to get things to match and look correct. And I think that, you know, not to the fault of any of the compositors or anything that I was working with, but I feel like there are so many bad comps in the show for that if you go back and watch them, they're tough. I mean, they just don't look good. The edges don't blend well. The lighting, you know, directions doesn't match. And they feel like what they are. They feel like something that, you know, was painstakingly rotoscoped, you know, in a very professional manner. I mean, to the nines, rotoscoped in many cases and or extracted and whatnot, where it could be. But I mean, there's so many examples of comps that I think just don't work.
Yeah. I have to say that this lighting matching is a big deal for me. There was a couple of times where Naomi looked like she should have been backlit because of the nature of the sun back behind her when she was up high on the island with Kong, and she just had a tremendous amount of fill light. And I know that you're going to do fill light on actresses, but there was often times that I'm like, that is fill light to the point that it almost feels like, you know, she's standing in front of a huge white reflector. We just didn't have sharp, dark. It was the quality of light on her, and by the quality of light, I mean it's transition from light to dark. It's contrastiness. It's harshness that just didn't sell.
Like if the same film were made under similar conditions today, I think that it could improve, because I wonder if maybe part of the reason why that happened that way is that, you know, while there was some pre-visualization for some key sequences of the film, I mean, there obviously had to be, and it was boarded out pretty well. I do think that one of the things that happened in the production overall was just that, you know, I don't think they had a sense in their initial sort of layout of previs. I don't think they had a sense of lighting direction, and so when they're shooting these plates, I don't think there was always a keen sense of, all right, well, what is this environment going to wind up looking like in total, and where is going to be our prime? Where's the sun? You know, where's our primary light source in the scene? And so a lot of the stuff did turn out with the blue screen and green screen shoots to be really kind of diffuse, and I think that really takes away from the successful execution of some of the composites.
That being said, though, I do want to get back to a point I made at the outset, which is we're judging this, you know, 7 years later, and we have to be really careful about that, because of its time. If we were doing this VFX show the day it came out, I mean, we would be hard pushed to get past the genius of VFX supervision that Joe Letteri brought to this project and the incredible leaps forward that it made. And yes, some of those shots aren't working, and many of the work that has been done by Weta since then, you know, is of maybe a higher standard when it comes to like a purely analytical thing. But then Weta couldn't have produced the sensational results it produces today had it not had the huge step up that Kong gave over what was already a couple of pretty good Lord of the Rings films in terms of, you know, stuff that had preceded it. So I just want to make sure we're not, I mean, do we think of its time that it was less than stellar? Was it off for its time, or was it off by today's views?
No, I mean, I think, look, undeniably it's a stepping stone picture in many regards. And, you know, I think it was actually like trailblazing the proper technologies that then blossomed and branched into what we have today on, you know, the motion capture components we've already discussed. And you know, just it was elevating the game in a way that you have to admire, and without any, you know, without any real editorial. I mean, many of the shots that Matt was just talking about with the brontosaurus and such, you know, they were complicated shots, and they were going to be difficult to do in that moment of time. I mean, you know, in that moment, like, how many of the live action elements with the Andaro character today would you just use a digital character? You wouldn't even have tried to shoot a plate and comp it in, because, you know, we've come so much further with just doing realistic skin and motion capture for the actress. I mean, you could have avoided those as comps at all. So I remember seeing it, and I will say, and it sounds bizarre, but you'll both relate to it, is, you know, your eye was only as sophisticated as the best work you'd seen to that point in time.
Yes.
And to see, when you saw a comp that wasn't so awesome, your brain would instantly go, that's a comp, and you'd go forward with the story. It wasn't until things started to be so hyper-realistic, you know, that your brain would go, what was that? Was that a comp? Was that a map painting? I mean, then you've got to investigate it on a purely intellectual level, because your eyes don't give you very much information to go by. So I think the tolerance, if that's the right word, for a clunker, if that's the right word, here and there was something that you didn't stop and, you know, stomp your feet and go, whoa, this is blowing the sequence for me. You just kind of, it kind of went by. I mean, you can only got to go back to like the films of the 80s where you could see comps everywhere. But if the film was great, you didn't care. And I think there was still enough of that kind of alive and well, even though the game was elevating, it wasn't as dramatic of a problem as it may look from today's perspective. I mean, that's just my take on it.
Great point. I think that's really true. Like how we would look at something today, you know, given sort of what we've become more accustomed to seeing now, you know, at the time when this film came out in 2005, right?
Five,
it was the state of the art. I mean, and it won the Academy Award, and I think deservedly so. I mean, the work of, you know, Joe Letteri, Ben Snow, and George Murphy, like the nicest visual effects supervisor in the business.
Well,
like,
and also Richard Taylor, let's not forget.
Yeah, and like the work that these guys, oversaw and were able to put on screen, I mean, just – it was the top of the game at the time. One of the other things I did want to just – oh, sorry, Mike, you were going to
– I was just going to say, I just think that we should point out it won 3 Oscars for sound mixing, sound editing, and visual effects. And I think it was also nominated for art direction. But it clearly won in craft categories. And I think the problem with this film is not that it was a clunker so much as it's just – it was technically a brilliant step up. We just all feel like it was maybe not – tight in its narrative, and so it's not beloved. You know, if this was a beloved film, then some of that warm glow would then go over the interpretation we had of the visual effects. You know what I mean? Like you'd.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it's partly that thing you were saying about if the film, you know, back in the 80s, you just forgave it. But I mean, it's just I don't see people talking about Kong and referring to Kong as a kind of treasured, beloved memory of my life in 2005, the way they do about many other films that have come out from that powerhouse in New Zealand.
Okay, so I would just have to say one last thing about this just from my personal experience. And I don't want to sound like Debbie Downer this whole show, because I did have met a lot of great people working on this show, and there certainly is some work from this project that I personally am really proud of that I worked on. And I think there are some fantastic shots, and I'll give you guys my favorite shot. But one thing I just did want to mention that this was a really brutal production schedule, post-production schedule for the 500 plus people who were working on the show in post. And it was not unusual at the very end of the show in the last few weeks, last month or so, for people to be putting in, and you got to do the math to see how this works, but to be doing 100, I did for, I believe, 3 weeks on the show, I did over 110 hours a week, 7 days a week without a day off. And this was, you know, pretty commonplace at the end of the show in order to get all the shots out that needed to get done and get them up to the level that they needed to be for the release date. And I do think that there, you know, this is something that happens in visual effects a lot where, you know, things get sort of, you know, back end loaded and everybody's working frantically to get something done. And, you know, there is kind of that camaraderie in the trenches and, you know, everybody kind of like I was mentioning earlier, sort of the gallows humor. And sometimes it can be a lot of fun. But this was the show for me that just that kind of workload, that kind of sort of nonstop onslaught and really feeling kind of obliged to and sort of the pressure to continue working at that level. Now, granted, they were paying overtime. I mean, Weta, I think they're a fantastic company, and I think they treat their people really well. I'm not saying they don't. But I do think that, you know, for me, this was the show that really made me want to just not sit on the box anymore and just get kind of, you know, take a step back from the business. I wasn't sure if I was ever going to work on another film because I was so miserable by the time it was over. You know, even with, you know, a hefty chunk of change in OT, I was ready to just sort of pack it in and say, all right, well, I had my time in computer graphics, and, you know, I subsequently went back and worked on, you know, shows since then. But, you know, my career definitely took a turn, and I find, you know, I certainly enjoy what I'm doing now much more than that, although I do sometimes miss that camaraderie. But I think this happens a lot in shows, and there is that burnout factor. And for me, this was that show.
There's no doubt about it that, I mean, I've done the 100 plus hours on, and that is brutal. I mean, that is actually super brutal. And forget money for a second and forget weather for a second. Like, that is horrendous.
You're even affected.
If you just do the maths on it, that's about 15 and a half hours a day, 7 days a week. But here's the thing. You finish your shift, and yes, you know, that leaves maybe 8 hours to sleep or something. Assuming that, of course, you don't have to shower, move from your desk to your bed, in any way talk to anyone or even do any shopping or eat or anything else that, you know. I mean, it's, you know, in reality, you don't get 8 hours. You get like 3 or 4 by the time you kind of come down off just collapsing as an emotional wreck in the corner. And that's certainly my case. It was
not like woe is me, but just to say that, you know, sometimes to get these shows done, people who are working on the effects, the people who are, you know, on the teams that are getting these things done, they work, you know, their butts off, literally, you know, trying to get this stuff done. And they put a lot of, you know, love and passion and whatnot into what they're doing. And I think a lot of times, you know, certainly the general public has no idea. I think anybody from the effects business, probably anybody listening to the show knows that. But I just think it's important to mention that once in a while, because I know people talk about it, but it's sometimes something that people talk about in hushed tones, like they don't want to, you know, sound like they're being ungrateful or something like that. I don't know. I feel like, you know, for me at this point, I don't really feel like it's there's any danger in me sort of, you know, saying how I think that pretty much sucks. Like, you shouldn't do that. I don't think anybody should do that.
Ty, I haven't spoken to you about this, but I'm sure you'd be the same. The thing that bugs me is when I hear younger people almost using the stupid number of hours they've worked as a badge of honor. Because I think with the perspective of, certainly I'm not a super young guy, but the perspective when you're really young is that this is somehow a macho kind of cool thing to do. And from the perspective of somebody who's seen those people actually have physical health problems and have marriages destroyed and end up, you know, just really kind of physically unfit, it isn't actually a badge of honor that you've worked a bunch of 100 hours in a row. And it shouldn't be a Red Bull inspired event to pull that on a regular basis.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, I've noticed it more probably in talking with students in the last 6 or 7 years that the notion of all-nighters, as everyone likes to use the term, you know, I pulled 2 all-nighters last week, and as though it's part of creativity, I would expand it to beyond the effects business. You know, oftentimes hear it when I talk to a group of students that are, you know, cinema majors or art majors or they're industrial design majors. It doesn't matter. I think that idea of a committed effort, which in its description is necessary, but when it translates to some kind of, you know, I got another notch in my belt or another jewel for the crown because, you know, I'm this relentless worker. I think that actually is a manifestation of youth and a lack of like life experience in many regards. I don't hear people in their 30s that have been working since they were 25, and I especially don't hear people who are 35 or 40 who've been working it start to have a romantic notion about that kind of labor. I know for me, I can almost tell you the day that it changed. It was probably when I was 37 years old, and I was doing a large proposal for a project in Japan that was a theme park, non-film related project. And it was just, there was very few people involved. There was nowhere to go for assistance. And you get to that place at 12:30, 1 o'clock at night where, you know, typically that's when you put on a pot of coffee and toughen up and just look for morning. And you get to that point and you just, you're spent. And it doesn't feel like you're going to fix yourself in the middle of that. You know, you feel like you're going to, that you do almost anything to get out from under the burden of that, that schedule. You know, that you'd literally pay the money that you're getting to do it to somebody else if they just please step in and take over. But I think that that really comes with age and maturity. And I think that when you're young, oftentimes, you know, it sounds very exciting and you've done it a few times when it's not a difficulty for you as a human. And it, you know, it's, you kind of shake it off and go on about your business. But, you know, the thing about it, I think to just kind of cap the whole thing off is that the most efficient form of movie making is to make the opportunity to do great work as painless as possible. And, everybody then is like an artist. They're doing great work under good circumstances with great results, and they can kind of have a camaraderie of joy, right? But that's not realistic, and it never has been. It's never been that way in cinema. It's certainly not going to change. I mean, all-night shoots are all-night shoots, and if you're going to go to the Arctic to shoot, you're going to get cold. But I think that when you're around people who appreciate that effort when they see it, and when your colleagues appreciate it, as difficult as it gets, then even at 45, 50, 60, 80, whatever, you can kind of at least walk away with the appropriate amount of self recognition, as it were. Not, it's no longer the notch on the belt, but you still feel vital and valid and those things. But when it gets on the other side of that line and it starts to feel erosive, then yeah, no one wants to put people there and no one wants to be there.
It's so funny that we could all articulate the exact moment it happens. It's like, where were you when Lennon was shot, kind of thing? Like, because I remember my moment really distinctly. I can tell you it to the day, because it was my first daughter being born, and I'd been working on a – because I was heavy in commercials, as you guys were in features, and I was a lead and had this big commercial, and it was for an underarm deodorant. I remember this, so I can just remember everything about this job. And I had to have a bunch of guys literally going to hell and back. That was the idea. And when they got to hell and back, they all had sweet-smelling underarms, apparently. But there was a lot of athletes running, and we had to make them dodge meteors and dodge volcanoes. And just like, it was a big friggin' job. And we'd shot it for days and days and days on location, and we'd blown up the sides of mountains. Huge budget. And my daughter was being born, and I got a call. And that call basically came in, okay, I know that you've just stayed up with an 18-hour labor all night and your wife's in the hospital, but she's going to come home from the hospital soon and you won't be able to be in here at work finishing this job. So what we need you to do is come in now on a Sunday and work this Sunday, because she won't be home yet, so she doesn't need you. And then on Monday or Tuesday when she comes home from the hospital, then you'll be able to go back. And so having gone through the birth of my daughter, which was both the best day of my life, but obviously quite a traumatic thing and quite exhausting, and it had been a very long labor, but they dragged my sorry ass into a flame suite, and I sat there by myself over the weekend finishing this commercial so that it would be done, so that no one would feel let down, so that I could then take a couple of days off to bring my wife and baby home. And then the commercial didn't go to air for 3 months. And that was the moment at which I decided that these people did not care about my welfare. And that, yeah. I was on top dollar, and we were charging out like flame at $1,000 an hour. Like, I had hot and cold running anything I wanted. I was like a flame rock star. And I was like, you are absolutely right. Every cent in my pocket, I will give you to just go away and never come back. And it was like, I didn't care about the money. I was just, you know, really, this is an ad for underarm deodorant. The world will not stop. You guys are just bastards. And yeah. I'm not saying that about my producer, because she was under a lot of pressure from people, but that was the moment where I went, you know what? This is not right. This is just not how you should treat people. And yeah.
It's just a good idea as a professional in this field, you know, like as you sort of establish yourself and you get to working on something, to really just set your own limits. Because, you know, I appreciate what you were saying too, Ty, but you know, I just want to make it clear that, like, it wasn't that, you know, I wasn't doing 10 hours a week because I was young and I thought it was cool to stay there. I mean, the supervisors were staying 110 hours a week. And I think that that kind of comes, at least on a project like this, in the end, I can't help but look at that and just think that on some level, somewhere, somebody dropped the ball. Like there was some poor planning or some release date got pushed up and like, you know, they decided to keep the shots instead of cut some of the shots, you know, and so the workload got heavier and the schedule got shorter, which is something that, you know, happens all the time in films. But, you know, I think that there are ways to manage that and to avoid it. And I think oftentimes too, just really, you know, defining and setting your own limits maybe is the key to that too.
Here's the other thing, right? Because my story was nothing to do with King Kong, but there are times that things go off the rails. Hopefully the only thing you can do if you're in the middle of one of those is try and work out what went off the rails so we don't make it happen again, because certainly I've had productions that we've been, you know, really caught on because of technical problems and issues, and it was no one's fault, not even the Romans, but, you know, sure. It was just that's – but you got to learn from that, right? I think what we desperately don't want to see is a culture where this is both admired and expected. And as you said, I mean, this is not a this discussion is not directed at King Kong or the Weta digital team in any way, shape, or form. Yeah, it's just about the culture.
No, and also just to be clear, I was only my primary point was echoing yours, Mike, which is that, you know, what when you hear this romanticized notion of that kind of work expenditure, it normally comes from people who are. It's still a bit. Of a dream, in a sense. It's still coming from a youthful vantage point who makes the story more compelling. And of course, you know, oftentimes you do find yourself in that position, and it just changes over time. I guess in a nutshell, you know, you approach it differently as you move through the stations of your life. And, you know, I think all good producers, all good film companies, and I think everyone starts out on the first day of any project and said, let's not find ourselves there. Let's not backload this, or let's not set up a pipeline or a series of, you know, checkpoints that won't allow us to be comfortable with the process through to the end, because, you know, no one sets out to do that. Always is too big a word, but it oftentimes is unavoidable for nobody's fault. And I think that if you go through that and you look back, maybe there was a juncture that was missed. And I think that's a little bit what Matt's suggesting, as opposed to more of a global view. I mean, yeah. somebody didn't steer left when they should have steered right. And what I'm just talking about is the phenomenon of prod production.
Pivot another way. There's one other thing I want to say. If you are in that position that things go off the rails and stuff goes bad like that, you said, Matt, that the supervisors were there doing 110 hours. I just should say that that is actually the hallmark of good supervisors, because in my experience, there's a principle of equal misery. And the principle of equal misery is that you don't say to somebody, oh my God, we're not going to get this done. You're going to have to work all weekend. Call me. I'll be on my yacht if you need me.
Well, no, I mean, these supervisors on this show, I mean, with Joe Letteri, Ben Snow, and George Murphy, who I work with, I didn't work with Richard Taylor, but those three guys, I mean, I think they are three of the best visual effects supervisors in the business working today. I mean, then they are just the greatest guys too. I mean, yep. And just so gifted and I mean, they were in the trenches too. I didn't mean that as if it was their fault, but I would say in closing too is I think really a great practice, like if there are, you know, any supervisors who are listening to the show or any producers, and I think a lot of facilities do this, is, you know, once the dust settles and everyone's had a chance to catch up on their sleep at the end of a show, is to, you know, do that sort of managerial practice of going back and bringing people back in and doing a really in-depth post-mortem on, you know, how the show went and what went right and what went wrong, and use that as a way to assess, go back and see if you can't, you know, look for avenues and ways and mechanisms by which you can at least try to, if not eliminate, certainly try to mitigate the times where these things would happen, where, you know, you are going to burn people out. And I think that, you know, a lot of places do that. I think that's a great practice, and I think can do a lot towards, you know, sort of bettering some of the working conditions for visual effects artists.
There was something that Cameron said at the beginning of Avatar, which I think, I don't know how relevant it is, but I guess it's relevant, is this notion also is like what you're actually doing, because when people came on to Avatar, he said to them, look, this is not and also ran film. This is the, I think his expression was, this is the Super Bowl of effects films. Like, you need to bring your A game. This is going to be really hard in the way that winning like a Super Bowl is really hard. And, but, you know, do it correctly and you'll get the rewards. And I will say this, that even though we've criticized the plot of it, like, you know, you guys who worked in the trenches making this film, you know, advanced the craft of visual effects. So it wasn't like you were doing all this work for a film that had no technical or creative merit, and that makes some difference. I know it doesn't make any difference in the instant that it's happening, but looking back, you've got to feel proud of this.
Oh, sure. Yeah, no, I mean, it's definitely of all the credits on my IMDb page or whatever, it's one of the films that I'm most proud of having been able to even have a small hand in, you know? Like, I feel really good about having participated with the group of people who you know, put the show together and made it happen. I'm happy to have been, you know, a cog in that wheel for sure. And it's a, looking back on it now, it's a fond memory. Although, yeah, at the time it was certainly a, you know, I was ready to get the hell out of Dodge. But yeah, definitely.
Hey, so we need to finish up. We've run a bit over time. But Ty, was there anything else you wanted to discuss about the film? I mean, we haven't really much talked about Andy Serkis, and I loved him in this film, and I think it's criminal that we haven't really more spoken about him, but clearly one of the great forces out of the sort of myriad of films that's come out of this Weta camp.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've enjoyed this conversation a great deal. It's always funny to see where the evening takes us, as it were. And I guess just to sum it up for me, with regards to revisiting this picture, was that the things that I had seen in it the first time, as I mentioned in the beginning of the show, were still the things I saw in it, you know, 10 years later. And both, I think, in the positive and in the things that I wasn't so keen on. And I think that that's another example of a solid picture, is when, you know, when you go back to it, if it struck an emotional tone with you, you can still sense where it came from. And if it isn't as jonesing you as much, you can oftentimes see, you know, where those things kind of went awry. And so to me, you know, it was fun to go back, and it kind of put me back in that time frame. And you know, I just get too sad with Kong. You know, it makes me very emotionally upset by the time he falls off that building. So it kind of blew a couple of my days in sad tragedy. But that's me.
Matt, any final thoughts?
I would just say, you know, looking back at the film, I think one of my favorite shots in the whole movie, and it's just because it's such a great heroic shot in the picture, is towards the end of the film when the airplanes arrive, which I have, that's another thing I really loved, were the biplanes. I think, you know, they had some of the crew members, including, you know, Peter Jackson and some the producers and stuff, in the planes themselves, which is kind of cool as the pilots. Peter Jackson even shaved his beard to be one of the pilots in the scene, and kind of cool. But my favorite shot has to be the one where the pilots arrive. Kong sort of pushes Naomi Watts kind of to the side to protect her, and it's where he ascends the tower. And when he reaches the very top of the Empire State Building, he whips his arm across and knocks off this antenna, and it goes flying. And he turns towards camera. It's such a great heroic shot. The camera's moving really fast, sort of by him, but sort of in that, you know, almost like that kind of Michael Bay kind of shot, you know, where he's in focus and perfectly pivoting, but the background's moving really fast behind him, you know, parallax. And he whips around and he beats his chest and lets out this huge roar. And to me, it just sums up, you know, the whole sort of the whole film in a way. It's like this just great sort of heroic, defiant moment from Kong. And I think it's really just one of the most beautiful shots in the film.
Yeah, yeah. I guess that is true. I guess those scenes up on the rock with him, he puts his hand out and she climbs in it. The moments that I would flag as some of my favorite in the film, and we touched on very briefly that spectacular moment on the ice, having a character that size and an actress seeming to do effectively a waltz or a dance, just extraordinary. There are about 800 miniature shots in this film. So I did also want to do a shout out to Andrew Lesney, who's one of the best DOPs in the world. And his ability to shoot, obviously we shot a lot of stuff for PJ, but he's just such a good DOP and such a force in this industry. And we obviously not the cinematography show, but I just do think that Andrew Lesney is needs to be just given credit, because, I mean, pulling this together would have been a logistical DOP nightmare just because of the amount of stuff that was going to be visual effects. But also he's having to pull a lot of stuff together when there is no ape. And it's, yeah, I just thought his work once again shone out. Well, look, thanks, guys, so much for being with us. Thank you for staying with us and listening to the show. It's quite a long one this week, but it's always a joy to talk to you guys. Ty, do you want to give out a plug where people can contact you or reach you? Or
yes, I can be reached at my website, which is alieninsect.com. There's a little contact button where you can find me on Facebook.
Excellent. And Matt?
You can always get all word me, Matt Wallen, at mattwallen.com. What does that even mean? I don't know what I just said. And you can also, you can always find me in the School of the Arts teaching computer graphics at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia.
Yes, yes. It wasn't the airplanes that killed us. It was running out of time. Thanks so much for being with us, guys. I'm obviously Mike Seymour on Twitter, but you can find me at fxguide.com. Until next time, see you.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright 2012, FX Guide, LLC.